Hello and welcome to the Talking Spirits podcast, episode number 18. First off, I want to say a huge thank you to the many people who commented and sent so many beautiful messages after the last episode with German first call bassist Klaus Fischer. Klaus and I are both very happy to know that you are enjoying our conversation. This last episode also made it possible for the Talking Spirits podcast to hit the podcast charts in Germany. We entered at rank 7 in the music interviews category and even entered the overall music category at rank 96. So a huge thank you goes out once more to Klaus Fischer for being my guest and tremendously helping to spread the word. My today's guest, Linus Klausenitzer, is a bassist as well. As some of you might know, my musical roots are in metal music. And for a long time already, I really like Linus's fretless bass work with the German progressive death metal band Obscura. Linus is actually not only an amazing bassist, but a really great guy as well. So I was very happy when he accepted my invitation to join me for a chat. We hope you are enjoying it as well, and I will be back at the end of the episode. Hi Linus, welcome to the Talking Spirits podcast. I'm very happy and glad that you are taking the time to be my guest today.
Hey Armin, thank you so much. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, likewise, man. Yeah, so maybe we start with the most obvious thing right now. So since I think 8 months we are in a pandemic, global pandemic crisis, which is affecting the life of musicians in many ways. And for the last couple of years, you have been touring a lot, traveling a lot. And so I would like to know, how are you today and how are you dealing with the effects of all of it right now?
Well, actually, I think I'm doing better than a lot of other people, just because of the fact that I have a side job as an IT guy. And that brings in the money for my living, for paying the rent and all that stuff. So I'm kind of glad that I have that side job that saves me right now. But of course, I play concerts since, I'm a teenager. And it's the first summer that I don't play any concerts. It's very awkward. On the other hand, I also, the band that I toured most with was Obscura, and I just left that band in April. So it happened more or less when the lockdown started. So I'm building up something new right now, which takes a lot of time preparing, sitting at home, writing songs, thinking about a band logo, different concepts. So it's a lot of work we have to do before we can enter the stage with this band, actually. So in that sense, it's not the worst timing for that corona crisis.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that because, you know, with many of our colleagues, does not look that well and they are in a very different situation. So it's great when somebody can say it's a hard time, but I'm doing well, like you said now. Cool. So let's maybe go back in time for a little bit, if you don't mind.
Okay.
Your path in music started very early, if I'm informed correctly. Your parents are both musicians, and you started playing piano and trumpet at a very early age before arriving at the bass at the age of 15. So my question would be, like, when you remember your beginnings in music, what comes to mind? What do you think of? And also, you know, how did you come to the bass and decide that you want to be a bass player in the end?
Well, very well informed. Thank you for doing that work. The story of, I don't know, my musical past is very comparable to a lot of other musicians that are in my scene, in the progressive kind of scene. My musical parents have, of course, a huge influence. There was always classical music running in our house, and my father took me to concerts very early on. They tried to teach me instruments. I started with a violin, but I think I started with 4, and I went to one or two violin lessons, and I was just freaking out there. I was running through the room, and I had like a little violin that I still have somewhere, and I was actually hitting it on my head and screaming, and I was like, it was not my thing.
Very difficult instrument to play, violin.
Yeah, and it's not an instrument that's like, what I love about the bass, you take it in your hand and you make the first note and it sounds like a bass. It doesn't sound horrible, but there are so many instruments that you take in your hand and they sound horrible if you don't learn
to
play
for a year.
Have a technique, a violin sounds absolutely horrible if you don't have some practice. And the same with trumpet. Actually, I learned trumpet later, but I kind of like this. I can't remember why I liked that as a child, but somehow music was there. And I said, okay, let's try this. And I played basketball and did different things. It was just one thing in the list I had interest in. And my parents fortunately had saw my talent in music and put me on a musical school. And there I had to play a classical instrument. And that was first piano and then trumpet, I think. And I played trumpet in a big band. And that was already very much fun because you know how it is as a musician. It's amazing to like this feeling of a team. It's like when you have some, teammates in a sport team or something. It's just great when you, work on something together as a band. And that's the same what happened with that big band. And we went to, rehearsal weekends together. And those kind of experiences were for sure something that influenced me a lot. And yeah, and then at some point I had to get bracelet because my teeth were a mess. And unfortunately, I had to go away from the trumpet at that point. I was a teenager and I saw my first Iron Maiden VHS. It's Life After Death VHS. A friend showed me and I stopped listening to jazz and was a super metalhead. I stopped all my other hobbies and then like metal was my new thing. And so the timing was perfect. I was actually super happy about that fact that I couldn't play trumpet anymore and that I finally can play bass, what I was looking forward to. And my father bought me a Fender Jazz bass. And he said, this was not like he bought it from a colleague of him. And he told me that if I play a bass guitar, I really need to practice. And that was also something that motivated me, the pressure. And then I fell in love with that instrument super much. And that was for me, really, it's like it's a cliche as a metal bass player, but Steve Harris made a big difference for me. And that was the first moment when I was super on fire with that whole music scene. And I was really, the passion of music got me there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for me, it was kind of similar, I started playing bass like when I was 12, let's say. And before that, I played classical guitar and piano. But when I was always attracted to the bass. When I touched a bass for the first time, it was I immediately knew, okay, that's it. And then when I really got into metal, that was where same with me. I didn't everything else which I like to do, like reading books or whatever, it just stopped at that moment. And then it was it. So you mentioned Steve Harris.
Yeah.
Which makes sense because, he's still, after all those years, he's a great player who also has a very original style, an original sound of playing bass. But were there, other bass players who influenced you or other bands which you love to listen to?
Yeah, I grew up in Bavaria on the countryside where there is, there are not a lot of cool people hanging out listening to interesting progressive records. So I started with very mainstream metal bands, and I listened to Manowar a lot when I was 14, 15. And actually now looking back to those times, I still think they have a lot of great records, and especially Joey DeMaio is the bass player Joey DeMaio is a very unique bass player. He also tried to bring in it total different bass sounds to the scene, and I appreciate that still a lot. Great bass player. If you listen to songs like Guyana, it's incredible what he does on the bass, besides his ego things that a lot of people like to talk about, but I've found that incredible. In the 90s metal was super unpopular. I was not that gothic kind of person. I didn't like new metal. I didn't like Limp Bizkit and all that kind of music. So I was not so much into the slap bass and metal. So I had to look back on the 70s and 80s. So it was Geezer Butlers and those kind of persons that influenced me more.
Yeah, but from, you know, from that point to, you know, to the rather progressive styles and also to playing fretless bass, which you do a lot. I could imagine, you know, it's quite a journey from the rather traditional styles to the modern progressive. So how did that happen for you?
When I finished school, I went on a music college, and there I really wanted to push myself to learn. Like I was not at a very high level on the bass, so I pushed myself to do everything possible to learn. And back then there was no possibility to have Skype lessons with amazing artists. So I just learned it the rough way on stage. And I played at four bands at the time. And I had sometimes gigs where I had to ask the guitarist before the song what tonality this song is in. So I was really pushing myself to my limits. And it was like really, I had some gigs that I was, I don't know. I was really on my edge of, okay, this is still fine. Like, tomorrow I have the next gig. It was really on the limit. And I played everything from a lot of cover band gigs that brought in money to folk music bands. Even like, I did a lot of different things. And out of nothing, another metalhead on that music college asked me if I want to play in a side project of him, which was super bizarre, progressive metal. It was very, very bizarre. And that, I don't know, I was not very emotionally touched listening to it, but it was so awkward that I said, okay, this, I don't know, it's a challenge, I do this. And before I was mostly listening to power metal and, I don't know, melodic metal and mainstream metal, and then like this whole dissonant, brutal, super extreme, ugly sounding music touched me very much when I had the first rehearsal with that band. And from there on, I kept on playing in that progressive genre. And that was also the scene that in the end later brought me to Obscura and most of my other bands that I played in those contexts. Yeah.
Yeah, but was it at that time that you started playing fretless?
I mean, at the music college times, I had to play fretless here and there. There were some pop songs we played in a band, and I played a little bit of fretless, but I didn't even own a fretless bass when Obscura gave me the call back then. They asked me to play two tours, and I actually had to buy a super cheap bass on eBay, a 6-string fretless bass to I like, how much time did I have? I like a month or so to learn the songs. And so I had to buy a bass very fast. And and I said, yeah, fretless is no problem. But actually, I played maybe two songs in my life before with fretless. So yeah, that was quite a challenge.
A hard start, let's say. Mm-hmm. You know, if we talk about metal music, the bass is very often rather in the background, and you really notice it when it's not playing anymore. You know,
yeah.
with lots of bands, it's like that. But with the bands you play in, the bass is very present and prominent in the mix. And as we already mentioned, you play lots of fretless. So, you know, your approach is a little bit different than the approach of most metal bassists. So how would you describe it, you know, for if you look at what you do, how would you describe it? And also, especially on the fretless part, you know, are there certain bass players who influenced you in, you know, in playing fretless inside of a metal context?
When I started to play in Obscura, I had the big benefit that I was thrown into the situation and I had to deal with it somehow. So I had to create my own techniques and work it out in that way. And that already gave me a certain, I don't know, unconventional way of playing the fretless in metal also. And it gave me also, I don't know, like that, I enjoyed it very much from the beginning on. So I think that made my playing kind of unique. And then another thing that is really helpful and that I would recommend to every bass player is getting one band or one project and working with this band for a very long time. Because I started playing in Obscura and I had to play the material from the previous bass player for 3 years before I made my first record with Obscura. So every night we toured our asses off. So we played those every night. We played shows, and every night I tried to play the bass lines a little bit differently. And I don't know. It was, I had to, when you are on stage, you have so much concentration and so much focus on what you play that you would never have if you're alone trying to develop something new at home. So I think that led to something that, I don't know, I concentrated on this one thing for so much time that somehow I got my own style that way, which I'm very happy with, because that is very, very hard to achieve, I find.
Yeah, I agree. But yeah. Did you, for instance, I mean, in metal, there were some players who already started playing fretless in the metal and also in the progressive death metal. Let's say one would be Steve DiGiorgio.
Yeah.
And the other one would be Sean Malone, who played on the Cynic albums. Yeah. Did you also listen to those guys?
Yes, they were not my favorite bands, but as a bass player, I really adore them both, especially Sean Malone is still actually my favorite fretless metal bass player.
Yeah, same here. Same with me.
Incredible, that guy. And what I find very great about him, he has, I'm like, I saw myself always as a metal bass player, and I like to hit the bass very hard. And Sean Malone has more that kind of Gary Willis approach, that he plays very, not very high volume, but he turns the bass volume very, very much up. But with his fingers, he doesn't make a lot of noise. So he has a lot of possibilities with dynamic. And that's something I love super much. And every little change that he does in his dynamic playing, you can hear, and it's giving it so much character. I love that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and if I read somewhere, I read the story that, you know, when Cynic was recording the first album at Morrisound, that he was just working in the studio as a technician and he played bass, but he had nothing to do with metal, you know, like he was rather like very much influenced by Jaco Pastorius and was playing jazz and fusion. Yeah. And they needed somebody who could play bass for the album. And then somebody said, hey, Sean Malone, you know, the technician at our studio, he's a killing bass player. Maybe you can have him. And then if you think about this album, I mean, I remember when I heard it first time back in the 90s already. Yeah. And still, I mean, even like close to 30 years after it has been recorded, it's like mind-blowing, you know. Especially, yeah. I mean, the whole music, I loved it always, but especially the bass, you know, it's like, so I can agree with you on this.
Yeah, actually, in the first Obscura recordings I ever did was a kind of compilation, and we made three cover songs on that album, and How Could I from Cynic was one of them. So yeah, you can see like we tried to bring our influences in, and a death song we also played, and a song from Atheist. Yeah, but yeah, so that's was also super fun to play.
Yeah. But also very challenging. I mean, like it's very hard to figure out everything. You know, the style of music you play, you know, and also your style of playing is very challenging and demands lots of practice as well, you know. So do you still practice a lot? And how do you approach like the technical element of it all? And also, like memorizing the complex song structures?
Yeah, that's a tough question. I think a lot of it has to do with pressure. Like really that, okay, we have that tour in a month. I really need to learn this now. Like that kind of pressure always helps me. And deadlines. And I'm very German. I like deadlines. And I hate being late for deadlines. So yeah. So that always helped me a lot. Memorizing is a very tough thing because it's really, there are not a lot of repetitions, not that you learn a song in an hour. That's very true. So one thing I absolutely, that brought always problems to me is when I read sheet music and I learn it from there, then I have super big problems remembering those songs. So I always try I have tab books for my own music. There are two tab books from Obscura, but I don't use them much when I try to remember those songs. I actually try to listen to my bass lines that I played, and I just took the bound from the bass track and tried to listen to that to remember that. Yeah. But I don't practice too much recently. What I practice more right now is composing. basically, because we build up Obsidious right now, and that is what I focus on most. And the other musicians in that band are excellent musicians and super nerds, and they have very challenging ideas also for composing. And I'm not very used to play quintuplets in metal and things like that, and that is quite a challenge. And yeah, just by learning the songs that we're just recording right now for demos and pre-production, that is already quite a journey, and brings me very much forward on the instrument.
Yeah, but also, like, you know, the physical aspect, like, let's say you are going out on tour and you have to play every night, you know, challenging stuff, which, you know, and if you play a show like every night of, let's say, 90 minutes with this type of music, which is a very physical thing. So how, you know, how do you deal with this, with the physical pressure? And also, like, you know, many people playing that challenging music have at some point get problems with their hands and stuff. So, you know, how is this?
Yeah, I was never a very technical, I never had a very technical approach of learning things. I always had this, okay, I need to sit down, I learn this until then. And then I was never the guy that sat down, okay, I have now 2 hours, I will play that one, practice this one scale now for 2 hours. And I never made it so mechanically, my practicing. So that's why I think everything happened very naturally. And I think my way of playing and how I give myself some breaks happens very naturally. So I never had problems with my hands. And a lot of people in that genre that I play in have problems actually with focal dystonia, this sickness where your hands make problems and your nerves make problems and your hands don't do what you want to do. But yeah, I was just very lucky with that. And I very early on, I also recognized that this typical guitar doubling thing that you do in metal didn't work out for me, because like the string makes big movements when you hit it hard, and I like to hit it hard because of, I don't know, the Steve Harris influence that I have. I like the song when the when the strings hit the fretboard, and that doesn't happen if you play soft. And I don't know, it's that approach. If my body is full of adrenaline on stage, I don't want to play like a jazz bassist. So those kind of things makes playing always very natural for me. But what I have sometimes problems with are my shoulders, actually. That's something if you sleep in a tour bus and you have very thin mattresses and you have a very heavy 6-string bass on your shoulders every night, that is sometimes that's something that brings problems to me. But that's basically it, actually. And what I wanted to say before was I don't play a lot of notes with my right hand. I don't try to copy the same speed as the guitarist, and that's something that makes also a huge difference, I think, because like I said, the strings move so fast that it's very hard to play that precise if you play very hard, and also doesn't sound very well because you...
Yeah, that's what I wanted to say, with many things that makes no sense musically.
Yeah, exactly. And you have, if you want to hear the bass note, and if you play a bass note, you want to have that powerful feeling coming from below and giving even in metal that groove feeling. And if you're like, if you have that kind of percussive playing all the time, you don't have that. It's just some noise, and it doesn't sound powerful anymore. But so I just, if often the guitarist play 16th note, I play 8th notes or even quarter notes. It's way more powerful and has a very great effect still.
Yeah,
that
I agree.
Makes it also easier. Like, it's not a total, I'm not killing myself with my right hand.
Yeah. I can relate to what you say. But, you know, I think with many players nowadays who are in this type of music, especially like the younger guys, I mean, YouTube is practically full, you know, with the musicians who are like playing fast and crazy shit. But with many, I get sometimes, you know, many, I get the impression that, you know, it's all about just the technique and being fast and flashy. But and that's what I love about your playing, you know, that you can feel that it's not just about being fast and being a badass on the bass, but you know, there's also like very like a lot of taste and feeling, and also groove, you know, So, you know, I always think, of course, you know, you need to have your technique in check and for what you want to do, but there's so many more levels on which music is happening. You know, there's also spiritual, emotional side, you know, and all of this. And so how do you see, you know, this type, you know, I mean, like the aspects of music, which are not only technical?
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks. That's a very big compliment for me. Since music is something emotional, I always try to bring that aspect in on purpose. And then with my first band, I did it already. And I like that Steve Harris, for example, like that whole approach of not copying the guitars all the time forces you to do something else here and there. And then there you have a lot of mid-frequencies free very often because the guitars are very low and you have the mid frequencies. And if you play like melodic lines, it makes mostly sense that you try to play something emotional or to support the emotional aspect of that part. And that's how I do it, I would say. But yeah, I think it has a lot to do with the way I grew up. If I learned to play metal on stage, more or less. I had a cover band that I played almost 10 years with, and we played on biker parties, and I played Maiden, Metallica, and all that stuff. And we loved that energy on stage with those bikers. It was a very raw thing. It wasn't an amazing sounding band, but it was so rough, and that energy and adrenaline was kicking in, and I loved that so much. And that influenced me still a lot to views. That's why when you saw me with Obscura live on stage, I'm jumping around a lot and I'm smiling like an idiot. And that's very atypical, actually, for death metal. But it's
true.
For me, that joy is, I don't know, very, very important for me. And I think if you, I don't even blame the young generation. If they grew up playing with themselves all the time, alone at home in front of a camera only, it's where do you get that feeling from? It's you have more of that kind of sound aesthetics that you work on more than like, I don't know, working on the adrenaline of your music. It's more between just the beauty of the sound aesthetic that you can work on.
Yeah. And that's what you said earlier, you know, how important it was for you to make the experience of playing music together with other people, with other musicians, you know. And it was the same for me. And I also would say, like, you know, with all the different things I have played and done over the years, I learned the most in playing together with other musicians.
Yeah, and if you only watch YouTube videos all day and you watch the same YouTube videos as all other bassists to learn the bass, you will sound the same. It's another factor. And if you don't learn bass only from other bass players, but if you learn it on stage, being in a band, you have to improvise and to be creative. There is no other choice. So recommending that right now is kind of awkward because it's simply not possible to learn things on stage. But if you are a bass player and you listen to this, maybe it's a good idea to at least compose with other musicians right now, or I don't know, work with one of those softwares that give you the opportunity to play without latency together with other musicians right now.
I mean, luckily there's lots of possibilities. And I would also say, you know, I mean, actually, it's so amazing when you come together with other guys and everybody, because everybody has a different feel, different perspective, different things they have found out. And so it's like, that's to me, like, is one of the most beautiful things about music, that we can learn so much. And actually, this never stops, you know, like the learning experience will stay with us as long as we do it.
Yeah. And I'm very often very lucky because I play with musicians that are better than me. So
same here. I mean, actually, that's the best way to learn. And also, when I was younger, you know, I always liked to expose myself in this kind of situations. And there were lots of situations where it was like somebody asked me to play with them, and I actually was a way too high for me, you know, but I always said yes, because I knew if I, you know, I can learn, and if I, so just jump in the water and try to not to go down, you know.
Yeah, and the good thing is that was also pre-YouTube time. So if you fucked up something, nobody cared. And so the mistakes is what makes you learn. Yeah,
yeah, it's a part of it, definitely. Yes, yeah. But like the instruments you play nowadays, the basses you play nowadays, they are also rather unusual, let's say. Could you share a little bit about the basses you play right now?
Yeah, well, first of all, maybe I got to say that I love having instruments that are not, everything that is not standard is interesting to me, because I know there are very many basses that say, well, what can you do on a six-string bass that you can't do on a four-string bass? And the four-string bass gives you so many options already that you don't need anything else. And if you can play like, I don't know, James Jameson, then you're a master already. If you can, like, you cannot get to the same level, so work on that instead of, I don't know, working on a seven-string bass. And I have a very different opinion to that approach, because I won't ever be a James Jameson, and I won't ever be Steve Harris. So the only thing that I can work on is myself. And being myself, I like to do things differently. And if there is an instrument that most of the people don't play, and I see, oh, I can do weird stuff maybe with it, then I will try. And sometimes it works out, sometimes not. So, yeah, that's basically my approach. So, behind me I have a list of basses from, I don't know, 4-string bass to 5-string bass, 6-string bass, 7-string bass. And what I like a lot is also those hybrid basses that Ibanez are worked out. It's called a Shula. It's a hybrid bass between a fretted and a fretless bass, and that's very exciting and makes you very creative. And they also have made a 7-string bass a couple of years ago that I enjoyed playing with, because it really, the more options you have, the more ways to be creative you have. So yeah, I enjoy that, and I love Ibanez because of that reason, because they are they're not like I don't know, if you work with a boutique bass company that, I don't know, take 5 years to build your bass and you make the specific things that you have in mind. They, I don't know, it's of course has its values, but the cool thing about Ibanez is that they make cheap standard basses that sound great for beginners, but also they make weird experiments with that workshop series. They really try to make, bring in new, I don't know, they bring in tools to be creative, and that's what I enjoy a lot. And I don't know, I go to the Ibanez headquarters, and there is another a very unusual bass standing there. I take it, and it sometimes helps me, sometimes not, but it's giving me a good, I don't know, platform to be creative with.
Yeah, I see. But let's say, like, on the 7-string, do you have a an additional high string, or is it an additional, so it's like an F string?
Exactly. It's a higher string. I got to admit that I got it in a fretless custom version, but normally it came being a fretted bass. And that makes more sense, actually, with a 7-string bass, because the higher you go, the harder it is to deal with intonation.
Intonation, so, and stuff, yeah.
But, I mean, also guitarists tell me, why do you need a 7-string bass that goes up so high? Like, that's the... Like, you're not a guitarist. And yes, I'm not a guitarist, but a 7-string bass sounds completely different in the higher regions than a guitar. It's just a completely different sound. It's also like, if you have a 7- or 8-string guitar, it doesn't sound like a bass. It's a complete different sound.
Yeah.
So, and if the guitarists go down, why can't I go up with a bass also sometimes?
Yeah.
It's just giving you more opportunities. And I like that approach. And I mean, that's a thing of metal music, but also in other genres like jazz, for example, you can use a 7-string also to play chords and for soloing. It's very versatile.
Yeah. But and the hybrid bass you mentioned, it has a couple of fretless strings and a couple of fretted, right?
Yeah, they're talking specifically about that Ibanez Shula bass, there are I think they had two versions. The first one was a white bass having 4 fretted strings and 2 fretless strings above. But it was cool to experiment with that back then, but I didn't dig the sound so much of the bass itself. And a couple of years ago, they had an updated version of it. It's in different colors, darker red colors and black. And it has four fretted strings and three fretless strings. And the cool thing about it is that on the fretless part, you have a piezo pickup also. So you have like the difference between those two sounds that you have in one bass is very, very extreme. And it's very cool. You can you can use it in a very different in very different ways. You don't need to use the tuning that is on the bass that comes from the factory, but anyway, so you can use it as a four string tuning, and the fretless tunings normally have like ADG, like the high three strings from a normal four string bass. Those fretless strings have. But you can do whatever you want with it. So you can make like six string tuning out of it or a seven string tuning out of it. You just put different strings on the bass and you make different tunings, and then you can play fretted with the low strings very heavily, and then you can sing with a fretless bass in parts that are more open. It's very cool.
Yeah, you already mentioned that you played in the German progressive death metal band Obscura. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think you started playing there in 2011, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, and you have been part of this band for like 9 years, close mm-hmm. to 9 years. And you did play on the albums, and you guys did a lot of touring as well, you know, worldwide touring. And so in retrospect, how would you describe this experience?
Well, first of all, in the beginning, I was very shocked how popular this kind of complex music can be. All my complex bands that I had before were super nerdy bands. We had horrible underground labels that, I don't know, didn't promote the album, went bankrupt after 2 years. There was no possibility to buy albums anymore. It was, I don't know, it was always a hard fight, and people didn't give it a lot of attention. And then Obscura came up and they had success. I mean, I didn't understand it until I've understood the way that virtuos music go viral on the internet. So that first song, Anticosmic Overload, that came out from that band, was going through the roof. People loved it, and it was shared a lot. So yeah, it's like, you know how the internet works. You make something extreme and people share it. And back then that was a pretty new thing in metal. And that kind of style went big that time, and I was lucky to be in that scene. And I toured with them very early on a lot in the States, because that's where this kind of, like, maybe some listeners don't know this term, it's called technical death metal, what Obscura plays, this scene. And this is mostly popular in North America, in Canada and the US. So yeah. We toured with it in the US, yeah.
And especially remarkable, I think, you know, is what you just said, is that Obscura is a German band, you know, and yeah. Most, like many of the bands who are like really big in this type of music are from the States. So,
yeah, that's very true. But the origin of technical death metal comes actually from a band called Necrophagist, and which is also a German band actually founded by a Turkish guitarist. And yeah, that was mostly the first band. It's still like the legendary band that had actually two band members that later left Necrophagist and made Obscura what it is, actually. Like, yeah. Obscura had an album out before Cosmogenesis with that single Anticosmic Overload I was talking about. But that first album was not successful, and it was not something very unique. And then those two Necrophagist members came in that I still make music with. That's I play with them in my second band, Alkaloid. With those people, this whole German tech death machinery started. And we are still more or less the only band in Germany with that kind of music. It's like in France, there are some bands that are pretty cool. But that's more or less in Europe. Then most of the bands are from North America. A lot of Canadian bands. It's interesting. And since the internet made Obscura big back then, we had the opportunity, like you said, to tour in a lot of places. We never played huge stadiums. We mostly played underground death metal shows and some festivals. But we could play them all around the world, what made I don't know, me being the a young 20-year-old bassist, that was an amazing experience, of course, flying to, in 2011, we made a Southeast Asia tour that just, I think was still my favorite tour to this point. We played so weird places. I always think back about that one concert we played in Surabaya in Indonesia, which was back then a place where not a lot of metal bands came to, like that conquering the world with different bands started when the internet became bigger and bigger and people used YouTube. Then later, Iron Maiden made this Flight 666 tour. And like, it's very normal that metal bands and pop bands play in different continents. But I don't know, the time when we toured back then, 2011 was the time when internet got big and the normal CD market started to break down. So we had, for example, this concert in Indonesia where we played in front of a submarine from the Second World War. They hung our backdrop on the submarine. Then the whole stage was covered in flowers because they said, oh, okay, it's a concert. They didn't know what the difference between a metal concert and a classical concert is. And then the concert was in an old swimming pool. So we were standing like on the top and people were standing in the area where there was water before. So it was very, very awkward, those sceneries, and they made the trip very unique, of course. And those kind of experiences were great. And we toured through Australia, Japan, I was three or four times, North America regularly, Europe. It was amazing. Yeah.
Also, with Alkaloid, you played one show in Egypt as the first German death metal band to ever play in Egypt. So,
also that is very true. This has also to do with the fact that metal got more global in general.
And how was that experience for you? You know, to go to a place like Egypt, where the metal culture, I could imagine, is not as free. To, you know, if you're a metalhead, you cannot live it as freely as we can do here over here in Europe.
Yeah. Maybe I need to tell a little story before, because we were also very lucky with Obscura, because the way that musicians normally live as studio musicians, it used to be like that you are invited into a studio and you play something there. But with the internet, also more, and like having music equipment that is way more cheap and way more accessible nowadays, and music software, way more productions are done. And a lot of people do it from home and they invite you as a session. Like, there are not a lot of six-string fretless bassists out there that play metal. So they often book me as a bass player and the other guys for session work. And there was this this guy from Egypt called Nada Zadik, which is an artist who invites a lot of different session artists all around the world for his projects. And he worked also with a lot of musical friends for me. And he played concerts with Hannes and Chris played their own guitar on that concert also in Egypt. And so we decided, okay, cool, let's bring also Alkaloid to, as a support band to this concert. And Aborted was also playing, I can remember. It was a very, very unique experience. I arrived in Egypt and I went to the place of Nada Zadik, and the first thing that happened was, okay, no power for the next 3 hours. It's just like the power system broke down. So I was sleeping a little bit to fight my jet lags, and I was looking out of the window and it's like you feel like in the place of ants. It's like really, you see so many people at the same time. And, oh, look, there is a fight on the street, people screaming. Oh, what's going on that side? It was really hilarious. And
was it in Cairo?
Yeah, in Cairo it was, the concert. And it was not long after all the riots in Egypt. So it was very unstable. And we visited those typical sightseeing points and they were completely free of tourists. So the country was struggling at that time a lot and was politically unstable. And then when the concert happened, it was also a super bizarre experience. It was a venue that was had no walls, and to the right we could see the Nile. So we was like standing on stage seeing the Nile in the darkness with all the skyscrapers being reflected in the water. It was very very unique. And then we had a lot of talks with the fans that were very excited because not a lot of bands come to Egypt. And it was unbelievable to hear the stories there, that only for having long hair, they were beaten down by the police, putting in jail, calling faggots and, I don't know, Satanists and hippies, and only for wearing metal shirts and having long hair. And still those people were keep on wearing their shirts and standing to what they stand for, that like there is just their music taste that, I don't know, that they go to jail for. It's unbelievable. And then they come to you and talk to you like, oh, great that you come here. You're so amazing. And I'm thinking like, what the fuck? I'm a privileged guy from Germany. We had a musical education more or less for free as a child. And they think I don't know. And they treat me that well. It's actually like I have way more respect for them than the other way around. It's crazy how what they were going through and what they do for the music. It was very, very impressive to me, that gig. Yeah,
I can imagine, you know, I mean, in this situation, an experience like this means a lot, you know, to the people. Yeah, but so when you left Obscura in April, the drummer Sebastian Lanza and the guitar player Rafael Trujillo, they also did leave with you. And as you already mentioned, you guys formed a new band called Obsidious. So what can you tell about the new band? And, you know, you already mentioned that you guys are right now working on the music. And so I could imagine many fans are very curious and interested to what's to come. So what can you say about it right now?
We cannot tell too much yet because we want to keep everything in secret. So at that point that we want to come out with all the information, logo, the full lineup and those kind of things. We want to have everything prepared. And I don't know, we are not persons that do things with, I don't know, half-assed. We really want to have it like the full concept standing when we go out to the public. And we are talking with different labels right now and really, really working our asses off for music right now. I never spent so much time in my life for composing. Every time we compose for Obscura, I composed a song, the other guy worked a little bit on it, and then it was on the record. And we were happy if we had enough songs for a record. It was a real struggle. Now it's completely different. We spend so unbelievably much time for everything. And we have, I checked recently, we have 18 song ideas that are more or less completed on the server, with that kind of complex music that you don't write, like, I don't know, in a punk song in one afternoon. It's really incredible. And we only take a very few percentage of the songs that we work on because we need to make something new. And therefore, we want to put this quality standard very high, and we only take what is really unique and what is not like, oh no, that reminds me of that band. Now, fuck it, then let's do something else. It's we really, really put much time into it, and it's actually we didn't. We wanted to go a little bit away from like being very virtuose and complex, just to reach more people, and because it's I don't know. So that was actually our plan. But right now, since we don't have any barriers anymore, we can completely go wild and go crazy. And that's what's happening right now. It's really the songs that we have there are things happening that, I don't know, musically are so, I don't know. It's hard to put it in words, but it's like that complexity makes the music very unique. There's a lot of information and a lot of little details, our new singer always calls it ear candies. There in the background, we have pre-productions that are sounding like full productions already. I have never, ever really put any time in anything else so much like this. It's very demanding and but very exciting. It's we have now the first time that we send out the first material to record labels, and now we get the first, after a half year, the first reactions to our music that are, I don't know, not from our girlfriends or family that anyway give you compliments only. And they are also very enthusiastic, and like the first feedback we got now is very, very good. And so I don't know, it gives you very motivation. It's a big motivation also to keep on working on this. And
next year we will be able to hear music and Hopefully also, you know, you guys will be able to go out on the road again.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
With this new project.
Yeah.
If we talk about like making a living as a musician, actually, so this is something which was never easy, yeah. You know, or has always been hard. But then, you know, like for the last couple of years, let's say 10, 15 years, the music business changed a lot due to the digitalization. And then if you look at the metal scene from what I have witnessed there, I would say, you know, it's a scene where the fans are still very dedicated, you know, and they love to go to shows. And also they still really buy the physical product. But still with many metal bands I talk to, friends I talk to, it's still very hard to make a living just by doing what you do. So, you know, how was your experience with this? And how do you see the business side of it all, you know?
Well, first of all, like an advice to every metal musicians that think about making a living out of this, don't play that kind of complex music that we do, because that is takes three more time to practice, it takes three more time to compose, three more time to record. So that is not the smartest way to do in a commercial sense, but for me as a motivation, I love it to drive myself to limits. And like, for me, metal is still the most, it's just the best genre for me, because you, I don't know, can always go for the most extreme ways. And there is still so much development in that music. That's what I like so much. Like you said, the fans are very conservative here and there, and they buy records, and they have still that feeling for feeling for value of music. And that's something that's really, that's something very rare in the music scene nowadays. So I like that a lot. So the fans are great. And you can do whatever the fuck you want. The more extreme it is, the better it is. And especially in my scene, people don't want to have the same record twice. Nobody wants to have Obsidian sounding like Obscura. It will sound like Obscura, as you cannot do anything against it, because more than 75% of the last record is Obsidious, but still we bring this to a new level. And I think people expect that also. And for us, that's a challenge and very exciting. And that keeps the motivation high for me to, I don't know, work my ass off for this, because it's so much work and it really, really needs a lot of motivation. There are a lot of down feeling moments, of course, where you, I don't know, ask yourself if this is the right way or not. And I don't have a hate against the digital developments, because as I said before, that's what made Obscura big. That's what made me play in continents that I would have never traveled to in another musical genre. And also my session work is really something that is depending on the internet. So when people book me, I was never booked into a studio, never, not even once. But it's a regular, it's part of my daily musical life to record stuff from home for people. And I love that super much. Also, another case was also for live gigs. I was once invited to play with a band in Lebanon. That was also something very exciting, for example. And those kind of things I only have because of the internet. So without knowing it, I used this benefits of the internet for myself. So that's also why I sometimes gave presentations and keynotes to on musical schools about what possibilities there are in music nowadays to make money. And because mostly in those, I don't know, musical schools where you get a music degree, there are mostly more or less retired studio musicians from the 80s that just talk about the good old times and tell you how you be good in everything. And
But they are not working in the business as it is nowadays. Yeah,
exactly. But so they teach you how to, I don't know, learn to play like those five bass players, because that's what they need in the studio. It's not like that anymore. The thing that counts is individuality, and not only in composition, but also as a session bass player. So that is something that I enjoy also. I don't like playing all the time sounding like others, it's not something that is very enjoyable. So I really like that people give me session jobs to have my sound on it.
Yeah, because they want you and you can do things which nobody else would, you know.
Yeah, and that's exactly what is great. So I love that aspect. And I even find it very interesting. I saw recently a discussion about the metal scene in Corona, and one person said that actually it's great that metal fans are so dedicated with analog products like CDs and shirts, but right now that doesn't help. Actually, the metal scene is not digital at all. There are no big successful metal podcasts or metal YouTube channels. That doesn't exist. So it's actually very hard right now that metal musicians are not very active online with metal. So that's they complain about that a little bit, and that's the downsize of that analog fandom.
Okay, yeah.
I find that a very interesting aspect.
Yeah, good one to think about. I also read that you are working on a solo album. So what can be expected there?
Yeah, that I gotta admit that has a lower priority because I started to write a lot of material already for the new Obscura album that was to come up before I left. So there is some material from there that didn't fit to Obscura, and also that doesn't fit now to Obsidious or Alkaloid, my other band. And with that material, I want to create a solo record, and I just also for the very first times in my life in that Obsidious process, I was sitting down and writing music without having any sound goal in my head. I never said, okay, the album needs still a song that is a little bit like that. I never have that in mind. I just start to write from, I don't know, with a complete blank page, no certain goals how this has to sound, or that I need to think, okay, yeah, this probably won't fit. So there are a lot of songs that are way less heavy than Obscura and that are very melodic and they don't fit anywhere else. So when when the concert is there for the first Obsidious album, that's the next thing I will focus on, probably organizing all those stuff for the solo album.
Will it be instrumental?
No.
Or also with vocals?
Yeah, some instrumental things maybe, but I enjoy working with vocalists also, and there are a few instrumental records that are interesting enough to keep my attention for a whole record. And I don't want to make a record that, I don't know, I skip, everyone skips after three songs.
Yeah. I mean, you're obviously a metal musician, and you already said like that metal is the perfect way of expression for yourself. Mm-hmm. But could you also imagine, you know, playing like all different styles of music which have nothing to do with metal?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, those times when I played all other kind of genres just to get experience from my student days, that's something I miss a lot, actually, playing good pop music, playing funk music, playing blues. Like when I saw you playing with Hendrik, I think to myself how great that would be to play a couple of songs like that. It's super much fun. Those, especially those kind of groove, slower groove-oriented songs are very cool. That's something I miss, actually. That's one of the one of the bad things about being the fretless guy in metal is you will do most of the time fretless bass in metal. So it's not that, I don't know, Sarah Connor will call me to ask if I play the next tour, that won't happen. So but yeah, actually it's something I enjoy, and it's actually a pity. If I would have time for hobbies, maybe I would start to have a band again in another genre.
Well, so basically you are very much open to also going different ways.
Yeah, and that's very important anyway. I mean, how can you develop if you don't get influences from other genres? It's I don't know. Yeah, for me, I mean, as a bass player, Rocco Prestia died recently. That was a big thing also for me. That's a big influence on my playing that, I don't know, probably a lot of other metal bass players don't have.
Yeah, they don't even know. But I mean, he really invented his own style with all the 16th notes and funk. Yeah. With all the experience which you have gathered over the years, you know. When you think of like young musicians who are right now starting out and they have, they feel like they want to make music for a living. Would there be any tips or recommendations you would give to them from your point of view?
It's so hard to do it right now because I have no idea how the life of a musician will be in 2 years and like where to focus on. All I can say is focus on so many, I don't know, things that make you unique. That's like being unique is the one thing you should go for. Don't only try to be a good instrumentalist, but also being a composer. I find that very fulfilling. Also, it's very motivating, and it, I don't know, it's not a mistake a lot of bass players do, including me. When I started out being a musician, I mostly want, I was always pissed that I'm a good bass player that that doesn't fit a place in a band, that didn't get a space in a good band. I don't know. I was always thinking like, what, that bassist has that good band to play in? It's unbelievable. I can't play better than that guy. And it was a lot of frustration. And that was very stupid. It's always the positivity that can make a difference. If I would have said, okay, then if I don't find a good spot in a band, then I maybe should do something on my own, make a great band. That's actually the way of thinking that you should have. And that's what I would tell the younger me, I guess, to be less pessimistic. And like I said before, musicians love to complain and business is shit. And I don't know, there are too many bands out there. Yeah, but there are not a lot of bands that sound unique. There was never a time as a bassist to sound more unique than right now. There are so many boring bassists out there and standard bass sounds that are programmed and that go for the same equipment, all of them. It was never so easy like right now to stand out.
Yeah, I agree. And also, I think playing is one part of it, and you need to have your shit together, so to speak. But from all the experiences I have made, I would also say, I mean, there's lots of people who can play, you know, but the personal aspect, especially when you go out on the road, you know, you go on tour and you work together with other people and you are traveling for long periods of time. I think that, you know, the social aspect of being a good guy, being somebody who's a pleasure to be around, it's also very important, you know, just to have your social skills together as well.
If you want to be a band musician, I mean, like there are different ways to be a musician nowadays. If you have a YouTube channel and you play guitar licks of 15 seconds and that's your favorite thing to do, you don't need to be a good guy, I guess. But if you want to play like your heroes from, I don't know, 80s, 90s, or like from the bands that you like to play in, then I totally agree. Don't be a dick. But that's not only a musical thing. Just don't be a dick.
Yeah, definitely. And also, I mean, for me, I would even go further, you know, by saying that I think that actually this is also connected, you know, because everybody, if you listen to somebody or look to somebody playing their instrument, it's very much connected to how they are as a person, you know.
Yeah.
So, and actually, there's no way to separate those two. There might be some exceptions from it too, but also, like with most people, like for me, the experiences I've made when I see somebody playing, you know, and I love what they play, and then you get to meet the person, you find out that mostly they are really cool guys, you know, very friendly, very open-minded, and in a way, they are the same way in life as they are on stage playing the instrument, you know.
I totally agree. And good musicians are mostly people that are playing very emotionally and moving emotionally on stage. And those are also very often the more interesting people to talk to. It's like when I go on tour, one of the things I enjoy most is connecting with the other musicians. You go into a tour bus and there are like two or three other bands that you tour with and you need to live with them for a whole month. and that's rarely a problem. You're always having a good time, and musicians are always very different kind of thinking people. And that's something I love about musicianship. And that's also something I always expected when I was 15 and people tell you, ah, yeah, but touring, you need to share the toilet with 20 other guys. It's not so great how you think. And probably when you play every night, it's not enjoyable. No, it is enjoyable. And the people that you have around you make it enjoyable. It's like most metalheads are outsiders in school. And then they go on tour and you have like a bus full of those people that think like you. It's incredible.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's a great experience to make. I mean, as you just said, right now it's very hard to predict, you know, how the life of musicians will be in 1 or 2 years from now. But let's say if you try and look into the future for yourself, are there any, like, let's say, dreams or ideas or wishes which you would like to realize in the future? For instance, is there a certain band or certain artist you would love to play with, or is there something which you really like, a plan, an idea you have for a long time and you want to realize it?
Oh, that's hard to say. I mean, keep on touring is already a dream now, that because it's not very obvious that it will happen. I mean, we want to tour with Obsidious, but I really don't know how the live market will be in 2 years. Maybe only very few bands can still tour. I really don't know. So that's a dream. I really hope that also the festivals will, I don't know, keep the size and people don't forget about how great live concerts are. And I just hope that Obsidious will be as successful as it can be. And right now, so that it's like little things, actually, like the next step I'm looking forward to. And I wouldn't do what I do if I wouldn't enjoy that most. I don't know. Of course, it would be great to go on tour with Metallica or Iron Maiden, but I don't know. That's not my life goal. My life goal is to make cool music that I enjoy with people that I like, playing for people that I like and that can feel the emotions that I want to express with my music. And that's already all I want, actually.
Yeah, sounding good to me, man. So I would say, you know, we are now slowly approaching the end of our conversation for today. So, of course, the guest shall have the final say. And is there something you would like to share with our listeners to end the conversation for today?
Well, first of all, thanks, Amin, for having me and for being one of the positive persons in the music scene that, I don't know, dealing with this situation creatively and positively and, I don't know, creates less suffering in the world with this podcast. And I don't know, being a great musician, being a great guy. And for everyone else, thanks for your interest, listening to this, support Amin's podcast, and follow my social media channels if you want to know what I'm doing. Also follow Amin to his musical adventures. And thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, man. You're welcome, and thank you as well. Really great that you took the time to get together with me today. And also, I hope we will be able to meet again in real life sometime.
Oh, yeah.
You know. And if you guys
Without distance of 100, 1 meter 50.
Yeah, and if you guys go out on the road with Obsidious, I will be coming to at least one show to see you guys playing.
Awesome.
Thank you, man. Have a nice day. Stay healthy.
Thank you, the same.
Stay safe.
Thank you.
Bye, man.
Bye.
You have been listening to Talking Spirits Podcast, episode number 18, with Linus Klausenitzer and Amin Alic. For the next week, we will stay in the metal realm, but change the language to German, as my guest is my old friend, German metal guitarist Stefan Weber. Stefan just recently joined the legendary metal band Rage, and we had lots of fun talking about how this came about, and lots of many other interesting topics. As usual, I'm very happy about you guys spreading the word about the Talking Spirits podcast and also getting in touch with me if you have an idea or there's anything you want to talk to me about. Thanks a lot once again to everybody who's supporting the Talking Spirits podcast. Have a nice Sunday and stay safe and healthy. Bye!